Blog Talk Radio.
Finally, I'm finally free. Finally, I'm finally me. Finally, I'm finally free.
Installment of the Black Girl Nerds podcast. My name is Jamie. I am your host. Tonight, we have editors Rose Fox and Daniel Jose Older, the creators of long-hidden speculative fiction from the margins of history. So if you are listening live right now, there's two ways that you can reach us. You can either call in. The number is 347-236-4616. Or you can use Twitter to contact us using the BGN podcast hashtag. Use that hashtag, and you can ask questions or leave comments throughout the show. We've got the chat room open, so jump in there and join in the chat with our live listeners. Before we get started with our guests, I do want to make a few announcements. Always, I like to promote our store we have at Zazzle. So if you go to zazzle.com/blurredgasm, you can purchase coffee mugs, T-shirts, keychains. We've got mouse pads, tons and tons of stuff with the BGN logo on it. And all of the monies that go into that store help fund these weekly podcasts because they do get expensive. So please show your support. We've got a new logo now. So rock those at your local cons. represent those and tweet pictures to us. We always like to see you guys in BGN swag. So the website, again, is zazzle.com/blurredgasm. Also, if you have a book and or you have a service that you'd like to promote or advertise, go to blackgirlnerds.com and click on the buy a blog ad link. There's currently ad space available on the website. So a lot of artists and writers like to promote their books and use our website as a means to do it. We've got a lot of folks that are bookworms, and we're part of the Blurred Book Club. So it's a great opportunity if you do want to get your work out there. And we have some pretty, pretty competitive rates. So check that out. And again, all of the support that you guys give us each and every day, each and every week, is always support are always appreciated, and thank you so much for that. It's just me tonight on the podcast, so the virtual mic once again is my name is Jamie Broadnax. I'm the founder and creator of Black Girl Nerds. You can always catch me and my musings on Twitter. I'm on there ridiculously through a lot of periods of time throughout the day and the evening, but you can always catch me through live tweets. I'm the editor of blackgirlnerds.com, so you can always find fresh content on a daily basis, content written by myself and several amazing contributors. So bookmark that site if you haven't done so already. And thank you again, guys, for tuning in. So tonight we have our wonderful guests, and I'm going to give them an introduction, and then we're going to start with our Q&A. So our first guest we have, Rose Fox, is a compulsive magazine editor with a lifelong love of genre fiction. Credits include Publishers Weekly, co-host Publisher Weekly Radio, and editor-at-large for 24 Mag, along with disassociative editor of the Annals of Improbable Research. We also have Daniel Jose Older, who is a Brooklyn-based writer, editor, and composer of Salsa Nocturna. Daniel's debut Ghost Noir collection has was hailed as striking and original from Publishers Weekly. His short stories and essays have appeared in Lightspeed, Salon, The New Haven Review, Tor.com, Pank, Strange Horizons, and Cross Genres. Please welcome them to the show, everybody.
Very honored to be here.
Thank you so much for having us, Jamie. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you for coming on. So for those of us that are listening who may not know, what exactly is speculative fiction?
What a can of worms. You don't start out small. Very broadly, speculative fiction is fiction that asks, what if? It posits that something is a little different from the way things are or the way things were. So that includes all kinds of fantasy, science fiction, horror, anything that says there might be something we can't see or touch or understand, anything that says there might be something out there in the universe we've never encountered. That's speculative fiction. It speculates. It asks questions. That's the fundamental drive of speculative literature.
Exactly that.
With this this narrative with Long Hidden, you use history as a backdrop for a lot of these stories. Why use history? What's the motive there?
I think one place that's really fascinating to think about is this intersection of mythology and history and memory, because a lot of times when we think about our histories, we think about them in terms of how we remember them and how they're told to us through oral histories. And then there's the history that textbooks tell us. And those are often very divergent paths and very divergent narratives. So when we're thinking about history, both in the sense of histories that have been marginalized, that mainstream white patriarchal history has either erased or turned into some kind of cartoon, we're thinking about histories that have been distorted. And then we're also thinking about histories that have more of a mythological element, so that things that we don't always think of as straightforward, you know, reality happening. And it's about trying to take on history with a sense of imagination. So on the one hand, imagining things the way they might have really been, the way they could have been, the way they could be. And all these different layers, I think, come into play so that it sort of opens up a new space. Because we're tired of seeing the same old histories that we know to be in many ways false or only part of the story. So I think coming at it from a speculative way is a way to open up that area and open up that space in our minds and our imaginations and say, you know, what could this be? What are the stories we haven't told yet but we know to be true?
And speculative fiction is also often a way of getting at a truth from a slightly different direction or at a little bit of a remove. So if you look at all the science fiction stories about encountering aliens, for example, those are very often metaphors for encountering someone who's just different from you, someone who thinks differently than you do. And using that metaphor, using the speculative metaphor, can make it a little bit easier for someone to face the underlying truth of that. And so we wanted to use that, to kind of turn that around, to use that tool to benefit people who have usually been put in the place of the alien, the other, and to say, you know, what happens if now we speculate, we who used to be the other, what if we now make ourselves the viewpoint character? And what if we use the speculative metaphors as a way of revealing our truths and touching on things that other people have been too uncomfortable to face up to?
How did the concept of the book come together?
We were having a conversation on Twitter, actually. which kind of figures. And we were talking about, I think we were talking about the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and a particular character.
That was how it started.
Yeah. And a character in there who was like the one black woman in the movie, I think, and just how different people relate to that character as far as on the one hand being excited that there is a black woman, you know, shown, which on the one hand also is just like ridiculous that they, you know, it's a time when in a place when there were so many black women doing so many amazing things, and of course there's only one in the movie, you know, and then on the other hand it being like a very cartoonish character who's kind of like the very typical narrative of like a quote unquote voodoo queen, you know, just not done with any real respect.
So
it was like this dual approach and feeling about the fact that that character was there. And then the conversation kind of got bigger and bigger, and I think it was Rose that jumped in and said, "Oh, this would be a cool anthology." And
that part is my fault. It's true, but we really have to give credit to Cassandra Taylor, who was really spearheading that conversation originally, and got us all inspired. It was just a phenomenal moment of people coming together around an idea and saying, where can we go with this?
And cross genres, they put out my first collection of short stories, Salsa Nocturna, and they're an amazing publisher. In fact, they're doing a Kickstarter right now, so we should plug that because they're trying to stay alive. They have a magazine and they put out books, and they've always just been really on point about being anti-oppression and being clear about who they are and what they do and taking a stand on a number of different issues. And they have a lot of clarity about how to be that in the publishing world. And they were amazing to work with for me as a writer. They were just fantastic editors, fantastic publishers all around. It was an amazing experience. So they were a natural place to start. I think, Rose, I think in your tweet you actually said cross genres, right?
Well, it was sort of obvious.
It
looked to me like exactly the sort of thing that they are willing to take chances on, when a lot of mainstream publishers would be like, well, we don't know if that's going to sell. And cross genres has always prioritized revealing stories, telling these stories that have been long hidden, that have been suppressed or overwritten or told badly. And so it was just a really good fit.
Exactly.
And they agreed with us.
I think the next morning I got a chat from Bart, who runs Cross Genres, and he was like, "Hey, what do you think about this idea?" And I was like, "Yes." Absolutely.
Wow. How does that happen? Because we do this all the time on Twitter and social media. We have these conversations, or whether you're just having a casual conversation with a friend and you see like Pirates of the Caribbean or some right. movie where you say, hey, you know, wouldn't it be cool if this was done into a book or if this was done as a spinoff? How do you get from having a Twitter conversation to having a published book?
That's such a great question.
It's taken us what, about a year?
Just a year, yeah. That was Christmas last year.
Right around then. So, I mean, Christmas 2012. So I guess it's been like a year and a half. That's kind of unreal.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken a lot of people and a lot of work. And, you know, we all had to do this around the other things that we do. I have a day job. Daniel's writing like 17,000 books.
And for most of the time that this was happening, I had a day job and I was doing MFA at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. But you know, the step in between that we haven't talked about yet, which I guess we're going to get to anyway, but it was the Kickstarter. But I also think before we even get there, I think Cross Genres deserves a lot of credit for believing in the idea so quickly and really just like being grounded in the sense of like, how are we actually going to do this? And because I'm not very good at that, Rose is better at that than I am. But and Cross Genres is really like, you know, what are the logistics behind this? And so mm-hmm. they get a lot of credit, I think, for knowing how to make a book happen, having done it before. And then Bart is a genius. He's a Kickstarter genius. He's awesome. So a lot of things went into it. I think it was really a team effort.
And of course, all the writers who sent us stories. We had over 200 submissions. We ended up pulling out 27 of them and working with each of those individual writers very closely. I think there were a couple of stories that we took with only minor changes, but some of them went through extensive surgery. And all the authors who worked with us, who were willing to be challenged, to be pushed, mm-hmm. to be told, we understand what you're trying to do here, but it's not quite there yet. And you know, they put in a tremendous amount of work, too.
True. And then all the Kickstarter backers.
Yeah, over 1,000 people who promoted, who tweeted, who backed us. It still just blows my mind.
Yeah, that was such an incredible thing. First of all, like we hit our first goal so quickly. I think within like 3 days or something. It happened so fast.
Yeah.
So we ended up going for our extended goals, and just the groundswell of support was so it was so moving and it was so real. I think people were really excited about the idea. So, you know, and on the one hand, it was just expertly run. Bart ran it, and like I said, he did a fantastic job. On the other hand, there was just so many people that were like, we need this to exist, and we will, you know, put our money down and to say so and to make it happen, to be a part of it, which is an amazing thing. You know, it was very humbling to be, you know, a part of that.
So from what I understand, you had a publisher lined up.
Yeah.
Why initiate a Kickstarter if you already had one?
Oh, well, they needed money too. it's a small, Cross Genres is very small. Like I said, they're kickstarting right now for the magazine to survive, and please do support them because they're awesome. But yeah, I mean, there's so many expenses, because of the Kickstarter, we ended up being able to have art and all that. But just to put a book together, period, to pay the writers, everything like that, that's all money. And Cross Genres is a small independent publisher, so they needed the money to make it happen.
Yeah, I should say the artists also worked really hard to get us what we wanted, often very short turnaround times.
Yes.
And they had to read the story and pick a scene from the story and send us sketches, mm-hmm. and they put a lot of effort in. But as for the Kickstarter front, it's like taking pre-orders. It's a way of gauging how well you can expect a book to do. And instead of the traditional publishing method where you invest a lot of money in the book and you wait to see if you get a return, kickstarting lets you get the money up front. So for example, that way all our authors knew they were going to get paid, which can be quite an issue with a small press. And so we could just pay them. And Daniel and I knew we were going to get paid. That was nice. And having 1,000 people pre-order the books, essentially, or otherwise put down at least a dollar, that sort of Kickstarter high five to say, yes, I want this to be real, was just so incredibly motivating, both personally and sort of business-wise. It let us know, you know, when this book comes out, how hard can we push it? Well, now we know we can push it hard because there's a big audience out there. Mm-hmm. So Kickstarting is a very valuable tool.
Well, first of all, I want to read a tweet. We've got our listeners that live tweet with us, and this is Sister Horror at Graveyard Sis, who tweeted, if speculative fiction was encouraged when I was a young one, I would have had a more steady interest in fiction over my life. The demand is there. Do you see that this is something that is growing, or is it still sort of a struggle at this point to reach a massive audience with these kinds of stories?
I'd say yes. It is growing, and it's also a struggle.
Exactly.
And the audience has always been there, but the publishers have not always been there, and so the audience has learned to expect disappointment.
Yeah, I think there's that. It's a great question, and I'm trying to write about this right now for BuzzFeed. I'm in the middle of an essay. But I think that the publishing industry itself hasn't really reckoned with how terrible a history there is of just racism and sexism in publishing. And writers of color know that because we're still looking at a very segregated world when we're looking at books on the bookshelves and a very white-dominated situation. So when writers of color and when writers who don't fit the mainstream of white, cis, and straight, and male, look at what's out there, you know, it's hard for us to not just conceptualize seeing ourselves as authors, seeing our characters, who don't fit those things either, as characters up there on the shelf, but also on a larger level, our narratives, like our stories, the true stories. And sometimes those stories contain things that are vehemently anti-white supremacy, you know, because that's true of our experience, because we've suffered
right.
under that. And so we wonder if that will, you know, be welcomed, or if we'll not even make it past the slush pile because we're telling a difficult truth about the people that are reading, often, most of the time, that are reading and making those decisions. So that creates a very complex dynamic, institutionally speaking, that has not really been addressed in a real way, in an institutional way. We talk about it on Twitter, and we talk about it on blogs and those places, but you don't see a lot of white people in the publishing industry standing up about racism or
right.
straight people standing out about homophobia. So that's where I think the need comes in, and that's where you see the groundswell happen with something like that Kickstarter, because that is so true, and people know that to be true across the board. And folks have been struggling under these different forms of oppression for, you know, a long time. So when someone says, look, I have this idea for a book that's going to be a part of toppling that oppression, people get excited, and amazing things happen. And I think that's what we saw.
There's also the role of fandom, of fans talking to one another and what they say. The fanish communities that people have thought of as being where science fiction and fantasy fandom kind of lives in the real world have been overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, often not very welcoming to people who overtly don't fit that mold unless they're willing to compromise quite a lot. And certainly in the last few years, we've seen a number of scandals as more people demand spaces where they can feel safe and welcome. And, you know, sometimes the old guard pushes back. So it's not just the publishers who are the gatekeepers. And if we talk about the value of word of mouth in getting out the news that we were kickstarting Long Hidden, that this was going to happen, there is also the flip side, which is that word of mouth can be very harsh if you are not fitting the mainstream narrative, and it can be very excluding. And so we have these sort of tiny, isolated communities often who are just starting to connect over the internet, which is wonderful. I mean, if you're one of three gay science fiction fans in your little town, you're going to feel very isolated. But then you tap into some in an online network and you find out that there's Galaxicon, which is, you know, it was just a convention, I think sadly defunct now, that was nothing but gay science fiction fans, you know, suddenly your eyes are open. You realize you're not alone, and you become emboldened to demand more stories that suit you, that are about you. So all these things are happening right now. It's a time of a lot of change, a lot of turmoil.
Right, which is exciting, and it scares people. Like Rose said, there's pushback, but I think of it as like in history, since we're talking about history. There are these moments of crisis, and there's theories around this that are amazing. But these are times when the dominant mythology becomes up for grabs, because things that shake up what we know to be true, what we think we know to be true, and all the myths that we have convinced ourselves are true about society, about ourselves, about identity, about culture. And in some ways, I mean, that's always happening. And in other ways, I feel like we're reaching one, and we're in one, we're in the midst of one. And you see that with science fiction. You see it with feminism. You see it with Twitter in general has been breaking open doors and having conversations that make people uncomfortable. And the lashback comes in the form of death threats, of rape threats, of people just trying to shoot down people's ideas, you know, based on all kinds of nonsense. You see it everywhere, and it becomes these questions of respectability, politics. But what's happening is people are kicking in doors because there's ways of doing that that there haven't been in the past. And I say, you know, that's something to celebrate. It's complex and it's painful sometimes, but what it is a time of change, and, you know, we need to embrace it.
Absolutely. You had some very specific guidelines with submissions. Where did those come from?
Rose was the one that wrote the main – we went back and forth a lot, but Rose did the first run of it. So let me pass the mic to Rose.
Sure. And by the way, I did a bit of Googling just to check myself, and I was wrong. Galaxicon is still out there, as it were. So for those of you looking for queer science fiction fandom, it's there waiting for you. So the guidelines for Long Hidden that was basically a list of, here are my worst nightmares, do not do this. And it came from literally a lifetime of reading speculative fiction. I've been a fan since a very young age. I'm a second-generation fan. My father writes the stuff. And I just read so many books that handled representation of marginalized people badly. And so a lot of our guidelines were saying, you know, if you have a character who is marginalized in their time and place, and something happens to them, like violence, especially sexual violence, we understand that that's part of the history, that violence, and again, particularly sexual violence, have been used to subjugate people since time immemorial. However, be considerate and careful in how you describe that. Like, we were really trying to look at the difference between, here is history, here's what really happened, and here's how we depict history for the modern reader. I read a lot of historical fiction. I also read a lot of romance, and so I particularly read historical romance. And it's astonishing how easy it is for the kind of modern mindset to sneak its way in there and cast historical events in a certain light. So we really wanted to be true to history, but we also wanted to keep in mind the readers who are reading it now. And especially for Long Hidden, we knew there would be a lot of marginalized people reading this book. And so we don't want to trigger difficult memories for people. We wanted to handle complicated issues, but we wanted to handle them sensitively. And then there was basic stuff like, yes, someone in your book may use a slur that is appropriate for that time and place. You know, they may, you know, turn on a woman and call her a nasty name reserved for women. That's fine. That's understandable. However, make sure that your narrative, your narration, does not come from a place of misogyny. So don't go around describing every female character in terms of her measurements or how beautiful she is, while completely ignoring what the male characters look like.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's like the difference between how your characters act and how you act as an author, what your responsibility is as an author. That was really just what it came down to. We were just saying we expect our authors to take responsibility for these stories that they're telling, because
right.
this has to be handled with kindness, with care. These are stories that have been abused. The stories themselves, they have been underground. They have been mistold until they're barely recognizable. If we are going to honor these stories, we have to do it in a way that respects them and respects their truth and respects the harsh things that have been done to them.
Yes.
So I perhaps that gets a bit too abstruse, but I really just felt very strongly about respecting the stories, respecting the readers. And I think that really helped us shape an anthology that is broadly respectful of those stories and of our readers.
And I think the things that we were asking people to watch out for are things that, like Rose said, that we've seen again and again, I mean, throughout time, like throughout history. And we were really asking people to do better. So a lot of the response sometimes will be like, oh, you're telling me how to write, you're telling me what to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever. And really we're asking people to be better writers, be more respectful of stories, of cultures, be more attuned to the depths of what's going on when you're talking about cross-cultural conversations, when you're talking about gender. There's so much depth there, and people tend to simplify things, and it's at the cost of the story. The story really suffers for that when we simplify those narratives. I was at Raising in the Sun last week, which is incredible. It's on Broadway right now. If you have a chance, definitely see it. But they played a clip of an interview with Lorraine Hansberry. I'm losing the name. Is it Hansberry?
Yep, Hansberry.
Yeah, she Lorraine Hansberry. So she is thinking about. She has a quote, which I don't know verbatim, but she basically says, when you're doing stereotypical, cliched representations of specifically black women is what she's talking about, but I think it applies across the board. She's saying that on the one hand, it's just offensive because it dehumanizes her as a human being. And on the other hand, it's boring. And I think that is so key. Like, both of those things are so key because people get all upset, like, oh, you're trying to, you know, make me do this PC thing. No, like, we're actually trying to, A, have you be real about who's a human being, and B, write a story that's not a cliche piece of crap that is what we've seen over and over. We're asking people to be better at it.
Yeah, I mean, I pulled up the guidelines now because I realized many of your listeners might not have taken a look at them, and we just had a list of what we would not accept, and it's a list of cliches. It's a list of bad writing, but you wouldn't believe, even with these guidelines, we still got some stories that completely ignored our requests. So we said we wouldn't accept any gratuitous or titillating depictions of violence. That seems obvious. We said no gratuitous descriptions of bodies or body parts or people described only in objectifying ways. No shocker, gross out horror. No stories that are all about how someone non-marginalized became an enlightened champion of marginalized people.
Oh, we got
and,
that.
And we got that. I do not want
the great
to
white
single
hope.
Out. I do not want to single out the author who, you know, carefully wrote that story and took the chance of sending it to us. But people, please read the guidelines, because it was so much not a long hidden story. It was about a white guy who went out there and saved the brown people. And I mean, there were more than one. And and it's just like we have read this so many times. It is boring. We don't want to read it again. We want to read something different. We want to read about being our own champions.
Yes.
So that was where we were coming from. It, you know, nobody who's only temporarily powerless, like the peasant who's really a prince, which has been told so many times, please, let's get away from that. How about peasants who are actually peasants? What about their stories? Those are the stories
right.
we want.
Do you see something like this transcending to the silver screen?
Huh. Wouldn't that be lovely? Except, you know, I don't trust Hollywood one bit. So, I mean, I think we have some very cinematic, very visual stories in Long Hidden that could make wonderful movies. Meg Jantz, story is just, it's so visual. It's about dreams. It's called Each Part Without Mercy. And there are just beautiful, glorious descriptions of dreamscapes that I would love to see on the screen. But, you know, do I trust Hollywood to handle the story of a girl who's half Tamil and half Portuguese in India when it's under attack by the English and the French? No, I do not. I do not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I agree with that. And I also think what's exciting is that there's also the same. We see similar things opening up in movies the way we do with literature. But it's harder because they're so much more expensive to make, obviously. But Tanana Reeve-Dhu is a great example with her movie Danger Word, which is a zombie flick. And, you know, they funded it with not a Kickstarter, but Indiegogo, I think. And that came from a similar place. A similar impulse of just being like, look, I'm tired of, I'm not going to be waiting here for like some Hollywood producer to call me up to figure out that my story is worth telling. I'm going to tell my story. And so I think that, I guess just to say that I have hope, although I totally agree with Rose. But it definitely, I think all the stories in there make amazing movies. I also think it would be great to have more short movies out in the world, because I know there's not much of a market for it, but I just feel like so much crap happens because people try to fit into that format. You know, like there's so many movies that would have been amazing if they'd been just a half an hour, and instead they had to be like, oh, no, it's going to be all this, so then it becomes, you know, real drawn out. But I'm excited about what could happen, and I think that this is a step towards people realizing how much these narratives resonate and matter and need to be told.
Yeah, I agree about the short films. I mean, I would love to see long hidden fan vids made by people who love these stories, and that I would be pretty stoked, because I do think a lot of them are very visual and very beautiful. I'm just such a cynic because I just. You know, I'm deeply enough in publishing that I can find the authors who are doing really well with marginalized stories. I can find the publishers like Cross Genres who are publishing them. I don't know enough about Hollywood, but also about the independent film scene particularly, to be able to say, yes, there are people doing this and they're getting it right. And I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they're out there, and I'm just ignorant.
Oh. And you guys mentioned Tanana Reeve-Dhu. She was on our podcast, friend of the show. One of the stories in Long Hidden is written by her, called Free Jim's Mind. And that story struck me because I love slave narratives. I know there's some people out there that are a little critical of that, but I love reading the kind of narratives that were told back then, and mainly because when I was a kid, one of the first books that I ever read was The People Could Fly by Virginia Hamilton, and it was told so well. I had the audio cassette. It was narrated by Virginia Hamilton herself and James Earl Jones, so you can imagine you know, Darth Vader is narrating these great stories, but I really loved Free Jim's Mind, and she even has a reference to John the Conqueror, which was pretty profound because one of the characters in People Could Fly was named John the Conqueror. So that just struck me personally, just because I had an attachment to those stories as a kid. Were there any stories in Long Hidden that struck you the most, that you had a personal connection to?
I think for me it would be the first story, Sophia Samatar's, and I couldn't say exactly why. And that's not to say that it's I'm not playing favorites. It just was there was something about it that felt very true to something that I had lived. Again, I know I'm being very vague, but I think it had to do with the characters. Struggle of being between two worlds, which is something I deal a lot with in my fiction too. The character is caught translating. He's sort of translating culture, and some guy hires him basically to go and find information about trolls in East Africa. And he ends up just really caught in the middle of these different kind of this kind of epic culture clash. And it's so beautifully told. It's told through the actual research that he does and through the margin notes in the research that he does and how he becomes emotionally involved in it. And I think that's one of the powerful things about all the stories in there is that they're so emotional. They're historically amazing and accurate, and the narratives are powerful and all these things that really matter. And on top of all that, the emotion is very real. Like you know, you get got as a reader sometimes. they sneak up on you and you're like, oh, God. Woo.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that would be my answer for that one.
I had a couple. L.S. Johnson's Marigolds. I'm going to give you spoilers here, folks. You know, plug your ears for 10 seconds if you don't want to hear it. It's a lesbian romance with a happy ending. And if you know anything about the history of les publishing and the publishing of lesbian stories, there were decades where the only way lesbians could be depicted in fiction is if at the end of the book one of them died or was institutionalized, because you had to have the moral that this was not okay, that this would destroy your life. And so it is such a rebellious act to write a lesbian story with a happy ending, and it's a
really?
I mean, it's a beautiful story. I'm nearly in tears here just thinking about how I managed to bring one of those stories out into the world. And it means so much to me that I was able to do that. And I mean, I love the story for itself, but I also love it for what it represents.
Real.
Yeah.
That's real. Just to jump into that, I think, the whole question of endings and happy endings is so huge because it drives me bonkers in dystopias that just end with these horrible notes where it's like there's no hope. There's a lot of, I don't want to give spoilers either, but there's a lot of movies that it's like we finally see, you know, a story that's not the same old BS, and then it just ends horribly, and you're left feeling like, well, I guess we're not going to make it. You know, like it's hard enough looking out on dystopias and it's purely white and realizing we might not make it on that level. And then when we do, we die, you know, and that's disheartening. So I love that there's some stories in here that just end with very complicated happy, but there's some happiness. And I think that's important. That's subversive. It's like, happy endings can be subversive, and I believe in that.
Right. And what discourages me, too, is because we had mentioned this, we had a podcast talking about the representations of blacks in comic books, and the author of the book, she's a black female who is queer and who was talking about the representation of black lesbians in comic books and how there's always a hypersexualization of men and women, you know, in comic books and books in general. So I don't understand where that comes from. What's the deal with this over hypersexualization when it comes to two men and two women being together in a romance? Where does that come from, and why is that something that's still prominent?
I think it depends. It depends on who the audience is, and I'm going to speak to this a little bit from my perspective as someone who handles book reviews of a lot of romance novels, primarily het, but also queer. I think that if you look at books written by queer women for queer women about queer women, and the same goes for men, you will see much more focus on the emotional development. And there will absolutely be some eye candy. You'll hear a lot about his chiseled abs or whatever, same as in a het romance. But there is a lot of focus on the emotional connection between the characters. Often, you know, they'll be in the context of present day or historical struggles to be out or to be safe, and all of that gets wrapped up, all of that emotion gets wrapped up in it. And you see the sexualization, the hypersexualization, when it's produced for a straight audience. And it's the same thing. Like, if you listen to politicians talk about why they have trouble with homosexuality, sooner or later, it always comes back to the sex. It's sex, sex, sex. And it's about how deviant and how immoral these people are. And you can't have gay parents adopt a child, because what if the child walked into the bedroom and saw them doing their deviant, immoral, sodomy things? And it's just this obsessive focus. I personally think it's very rude to speculate about somebody's sexual orientation if they haven't told you, but you will certainly see a lot of that sort of speculation about, why are you thinking about gay sex so much? I'm gay and I don't think about gay sex this much. So it's really, you know, it's that focus on deviance, on it being sort of naughty or dirty or outrageous in some way, and that's titillating. That's the presentation for the mainstream audience. And once you're inside the world, once you are coming at it from the perspective of someone who's queer, you're like, yes, I know, we have sex. I've done that. It was pretty great. And, you know, it's fun to read about, but that's not all there is to life. Because if you are living your life as a queer person, you know that you get up out of your queer bed and you make your queer coffee and you put on your queer clothes and you go to your queer job. You know, like it's not all about your queerness. So it's very much an insider outsider perspective issue. Mm.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Daniel.
No, I just wanted to throw in there too. I think it also on top of that, there's the angle of simple patriarchy. There's nothing simple about patriarchy, but there's such a long history of men, straight men, not always even straight men, but men making movies and making literature, that whenever there's a lesbian involved, it's completely sexualized, and it's for the benefit of men, of men watching, or somehow that's, and or they're bisexual, and the bisexuality is for the benefit of men. And that's something to be said and to be clear on, because it just plays into, again, I think that thing we were talking about earlier, which is that it's also boring at this point. Like, that we know that will happen. You know, there's a female character that's bisexual, that it's going to somehow be sexualized. That's trite. So it's like, how do we get past that and come up with new things which are actually truer things to, you know, what we know to be the world around us.
Yeah, absolutely. Who are some of the authors that are included in these stories?
Well, the first thing I want to say about that is that we have a lot of first-time authors, and I think that is so awesome about this book. There's a whole range, though. There's people with a lot of name recognition, Tanana Rivdu and Ken Liu and Victor Laval. People that have won, you know, big awards, and there's people that have not published any stories until now. And I think that diversity of experience in publishing is something that makes the book outstanding in its own right. And we didn't go out there to do that. We had no interest in trying to get that. I mean, we wanted that diversity, but we weren't looking for it when we selected the stories at all. That happened really, really naturally, and I think it's pretty amazing how that worked out.
Yeah, I was actually really surprised, given how polished some of the stories were, to hear that they were first-time publications or first pro publications. But it's worth remembering that a first pro publication might come from someone who's written fan fiction for 20 years. You know, so it is diversity of publishing experience, but that doesn't even necessarily tell you about diversity of or length of writing experience. And I just want to give a shout out to all the fan fiction authors out there who are creating alternate universes so that they can see themselves in fiction, because that has been one of the major, major, major outlets for people who really want representation that is not there. Yes, a lot of flash fiction is just straight women who want to read about gay men having sex, no question. But there is also so much queer fan fiction out there that is just people saying, there are no queer characters. let me make one, because that is what I feel I have the power to do, that if that's how I'm going to get a queer character on this TV show or in this series of books, if the only way it's going to happen is that I'm going to do it, then I'm going to do it. And I think that and the community support for that also within fan fiction is going to be a really interesting driver of the next generation, particularly of speculative writers.
Yeah, very much so. But also, to answer the question a little more, I mean, we really tried to just get the word out as much as we could, right, Rose? I mean, we really
oh, yeah, everywhere.
We put it on Twitter. I think we were really interested in trying to get at writers that don't necessarily feel comfortable in the genre community because of all the things we've been talking about. We were trying to reach people that don't even necessarily think of themselves as writers because that's not, you know, what's encouraged. And so, you know, we really reached out. We really put the message out as far and wide as we could get it, and we're intentional about that because it's sort of easy to just reach out into the same sort of message boards that all genre anthologies go to. But we really wanted to make a point of going beyond that. And I also think it's sort of fascinating. I personally just think it's amazing to see what writers who don't normally take on speculative fiction do with it when they're challenged by that kind of idea, you know. So some of the writers, that's not what they do. Speculative fiction is not what they do. They are firmly standing in the reality side of writing. And so, but they were like, all right, you know, this is an amazing project. Let me see what I can come up with. Jamie Hatley is the one I'm thinking of off the top of my head, but there's a few of them. Jamie isn't normally, she doesn't write short stories, and she doesn't write speculative until now. And she totally, when I read that story, it blew my mind. And I think that part of that comes from people going a little bit outside of themselves and trying something different, but it also comes from us as editors asking people, you know, asking people to try, you know, bring in a contrast to what they're used to. And the results are amazing.
And speaking of people pushing themselves, when I read Jamie's story, I didn't get it. And, you know, Jamie, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I just didn't get it. I was just like, this makes no sense to me. And Daniel's like, no, you don't understand. There's a transcendent story here. And he went off and he worked with her. We divided the stories up. Each of us edited half of them. And he worked with her to make that story shine. And by the time I saw the finished version, I was like, oh, yes, okay, I see what you were going for now. And because we worked together and because we challenged each other this way, like I picked up at least one story out of the slush pile where Dan was like, really? I said, yes, really, just trust me. And he said, okay, well, then this one, just trust me. And we did. We trusted each other and we pushed ourselves. And that was, I think that was essential to making this anthology work, because if we had stayed within our own comfort zones, in some ways we would have let down all of the authors who push themselves to really tell these, in some ways, very emotionally difficult stories, but yeah, we also would have let down our readers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I think that's also one of the strengths of the project in general, is that Rose and I have different opinions, which is great, you know, which was led to fascinating discussions. I learned, and I've said this before, I learned so much just doing this project that, you know, I just feel like I've walked away from it, like, winning on so many levels. And so much of that is from...
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah, and so much of that is from our conversations and the fact that we have differences, you know, real real major differences. And then the places that we come together are really interesting, too, and finding those, you know, those places where, like, oh, okay, and then where we have to settle. And it's been fascinating. It's been really amazing.
We got a question on Twitter from Marmar82. He wants to know, when will another posting for stories be posted so I can enter a story or two?
Well, we don't yet know if we're going to do another Long Hidden Style anthology. We've talked about it. There is interest, I would say. But again, you know, we've got so much other stuff going on in our lives, it's hard to know whether we can really make it happen. So we're considering it. But in the meantime, I would absolutely encourage every writer who's listening to this to write a long hidden style story, to take some time in history when there was a story, a marginalized story that was suppressed or mistold, to tell it right and to send that story out to anywhere, because the idea was never for Long Hidden to be the only place you could find these stories. We wanted stories we rejected to find homes other places. We wanted, you know, every one of those stories that came into us to find a home somewhere. And for these, it is sort of subversive, I guess. But we wanted to kind of infect all the other speculative anthologies and magazines out there with historical stories being told properly for the first time, with marginalized stories being told properly. And that was a really important part of the project for me.
And I would say go to crossgenres.com, because they have a magazine and they do different themes every issue. I just finished editing the music theme, which is coming up, and they're doing amazing stuff. So there, and you know, look around. There's a lot of speculative fiction markets. Strange Horizons is great. That are doing good work. That things that, you know, like Rose said, that if you write a long hidden type story, they will go there, and that's great.
Well, we're about 5 minutes into the end of the show. I just want to ask one final question. What surprised you the most from Long Hidden, and what did you learn while making it?
Well, that shouldn't be hard to answer. go ahead, Rose.
oh, thank you very much. What surprised me? Some of those stories that we brought in really surprised me. I thought I had an idea of what sorts of stories we were going to see, and to an extent I was right. But stories came in about times and places that I'd never heard of, never thought of. We have a story, Christina Lynch's The Heart and the Feather, which is about people with a certain genetic trait that I'd never heard of. They have hair growing all over their bodies, and in the time period that she's writing about, they were sort of seen as sideshow freaks, and despite being human beings like anyone else. And so those are the marginalized characters in her story. And to encounter that was just, you know, eye-opening, world-broadening for me. And what I learned is that when I edit, I look at the sentence level, and that's just sort of where I naturally fall. I'm trained as a copy editor. I'm trained to be a nitpicker. And working with Daniel and seeing how he shapes a story from starting from the story and in a more holistic way, getting away from the rules and structure that I tend to rely on very heavily, and looking more at emotion and theme and heart. I think it was really important for me as an editor to learn how much that matters. It was very easy for me to overlook that, and that can lead to creating a story that's sort of structurally sound, but it's a house but not a home, you know. And I'm really so glad I had the chance to work with Daniel and see that other way of editing.
Thank you, Rose. I feel the same way. And I'd say, as far as surprise, you know, I knew we were going to get funded, but I did not know that it would happen so fast. And I did not know that we would raise as much as we did and be able to, you know, have illustrations and have a bigger book and have the cover's amazing. You all have to look at the cover, but, you know, wraparound cover, all these things that, you know, taken individually are just really cool. They're really, really cool, actually, and they just make the book super, super cool. But also when you look at them in the context of the fact that we were just so overwhelmingly supported by people, that was really like the sheer amount of the support did really just like blow me away. And then the stories, like Rose said, I was just blown away by how much great stories came to us, how many great stories came to us. We rejected many amazing stories and by many amazing writers. So just to the blessing of being able to read all that great work was just so, you know, I'll just always have that with me as a writer and as an editor. It's been an amazing experience.
Yeah, I feel really privileged to have worked mm-hmm. with these authors and with Daniel and yeah. with the folks at Cross Genres and with our illustrators. Mm-hmm. Who I feel like we gave kind of short shrift here, and I'm sorry about that because we have some incredible art in there by some wonderful artists. And to just be part of this team and this project has been magnificent.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, we're about to get cut off in a moment, but before the show cuts off live, folks can listen in to the downloaded podcast via iTunes and Stitcher. I just wanted to ask, where can listeners get a copy of Long Hidden, and where can they find more about Cross Genre?
You can go to longhidden.com. Longhidden.com is where you can learn about the anthology, sign up for our mailing list. It'll be published May 9th. If you're in the New York area, we're having a launch party May 10th, so get on the mailing list. You'll get some information about that. We'll also be having reading events at WisCon and ReaderCon, which are a couple of speculative fiction conventions. So our authors are going to be there and reading, and also at Fantastic Fiction in July in New York City. So we'll be out there and around, and you can absorb Long Hidden any way that you like.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much, Rose. Thank you, Daniel. This was a great show. So informative. I think there was a lot of great takeaways, too. So I really appreciate you having you on. Next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will have Maya Glick. She is the creator of Rain, a Storm fan film, and she also did a Kickstarter and got her film funded and went over, and right now she's currently in production. So she's going to be on with us next week to talk about that. So same time, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Rose. Great, great show. Appreciate having you on.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Take care, guys.
Finally,
bye.
I'm finally free. Finally, I'm finally me. Finally, I'm finally free. Finally, I'm finally me.
To play.